Hi, I'm Dahlia Lithwick, legal correspondent, author, and host of Slate's Amicus Podcast, a show about the rule of law, the law, and the Supreme Court justices who interpret it for the rest of us. I've been watching the High Court for over two decades, and I bring all that experience and knowledge to examining the U.S. justice system and democracy. Each episode, I am joined by guests with deep knowledge of the law and policy who help me and you navigate our constitutional landscape. Slate's Amicus Podcast. Subscribe now wherever you listen.
Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. If you want to know more about our robot AI overlords, today's the day to listen. My guest is famous shitposter and accomplished law and philosophy professor Scott Shapiro, who can talk you and me off the ledge. Scott is here to talk about this crazy new book called Fancy Bear Goes Fishing. That's fishing with a PH, but fancy with an F, as in Fancy Bear, that Russian hack. The subtitle of the book is The Dark History of the Information Age, in five extraordinary hacks. He could have been a computer scientist, but instead, Scott has eked out a meager existence as a Charles F. Southman Professor of Law and Professor of Philosophy at Yale Law School. His areas of interest include jurisprudence, international law, constitutional law, criminal law, and cybersecurity. Scott is also the founding director of the Yale Cybersecurity Lab. If you don't entirely trust me, but you should, that this is a must-read book, here's some praise about Fancy Bear from author Garrett Graff. He called it accessible for regular readers, yet still fun for experts. This delightful book expertly traces the challenges of securing our digital lives and how the optimism of the internet's early pioneers has resulted in an online world today threatened by spies, criminals, and overeager teen hackers. I have a confession, which is that I am not typically intimidated by my guests here on Booked Up, but I am deeply worried that Scott may have hacked into the computer network at Yale to see that I shopped but dropped after the first week an introduction to philosophy course in college, mainly because I didn't think Leibniz monad seemed realistic. But now the joke is on me, because what the hell is Twitter or your Twitter timeline really if it's not made up of monads? Okay, let's dive in. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jen. How you doing?
I'm good. Are you still eating your lunch, or is that sort of just a nervous swipe of your hand across your face?
I did just finish my lunch, and it was based on past experiences. I have had food in my in facial hair. I did not want to inflict that.
Yeah,
on.
Yeah. That's very kind of you. What was lunch today?
Oh, it was, so I'm a big fan of turkey on rye with mustard and coleslaw, any deli sandwich, tongue, corned beef, all that stuff. I'm a big fan. Yourself?
Well, with coleslaw though?
Yeah, coleslaws.
You're not kosher. Coleslaw has dairy in it, no?
No, coleslaw does not have dairy in it, and I was kosher. I was an Orthodox Jew for 14 years, from 12 years, from 14 to 26. But I'm not religious at all anymore. My wife's not Jewish. My kids were not raised as Jews, although they were raised on the East Coast, so they were. What about you? Are you?
Well, I'm kosher by default, other than the shrimp, I think. No, I mean, I'm kosher by default because I'm a sort of pescatarian type person. But we now don't, my husband decided after he watched a documentary about the oceans that we shouldn't eat fish anymore. So since he's the one who does more of the cooking. So basically, it's hard not to be kosher if you have no anything but cheese in the house. You know what I mean?
Right.
And soy.
Right. I
and
see.
Stuff
but
like that.
Is it meaningful to you to be kosher?
It's meaningful for me to be a vegetarian because I feel like things that have faces we shouldn't eat. But like, I mean, I don't criticize others for doing it because there's plenty of stuff I'm sure that I do to harm the world.
No, I just meant like how
I know.
Yeah, yeah.
The kosher thing. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm a semi-practicing, I guess, reform. I was raised as a reform Jew, but the closest synagogue to me, like literally a block away, is conservative. But this is Northampton, so like our synagogue has a farm on it, and it supplies the food to the survival center next door. And
I see.
It's pretty chill.
I will just say that. So I grew up. I went to yeshiva my whole life, from 5 to 18, and then I went to Israel and studied. In Israel, I could have gotten smicha, but I would just say that I have no...
What does smicha mean?
Smicha is ordination.
Oh, okay, got you.
For to be a rabbi, but yeah. I've given it up 100% completely, so...
There's a connection with this thread, though, because, you know, Jewish teaching, obviously, is very centered in law. And I would say philosophy, and here you are doing law and philosophy. So, like, is it that much of a pivot? Like, do you see the connections?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the reason why I became religious was I was so drawn into law and legal theory. And it was only when I went to graduate school studying philosophy, that I felt the same kind of attachment to ideas and law and jurisprudence, and I realized, wait a second, maybe I just really want to be a legal theorist instead of an Orthodox Jew. So that's what happened for me.
Do you like philosophy because there are no answers? Is that you enjoy?
No, I hate that about philosophy.
I really do.
No, I just say I hate that about philosophy. I hate like some law, like, you know, people who do criminal law. I stopped teaching criminal law. I taught it for like 12 years. I stopped teaching because I just didn't know the answer to anything. Like, why are attempts punished less than the completed crimes? And I don't know the answer to that. And I hated not knowing the answer to that.
Well, so. Can it just be inertia? Can the answer just be that's how it's been and people don't want to change it despite that? I mean, we know that the arguments are sometimes for these things, but sometimes things are just kept the way they're kept out of like vestiges. Let me give you an example. This is not philosophy, but this is something my husband mentioned to me once. I see that you're not wearing a tie. Do you ever wear ties?
I don't have a tie. I don't actually own a shoe. Shoes. I don't actually own a suit. I have one sport jacket and...
You don't own shoes? What do you wear? Barefoot? You go barefoot?
No, sneakers. I always wear like these sneakers.
Oh, those are shoes. Those count as shoes, Scott.
Yeah, well, I mean,
okay,
I just...
Okay, yeah. So I'm so glad because have you... I mean, ties. I mean, do you know why men used to wear ties?
I have no idea.
Okay. This is according to Michael and I haven't Googled it. So let's just assume it's truthful because this is like worse. Here's our premise. The following is true. It used to be that... You know, back in the day before there was like mechanized washing machines and such, your shirts, like a men's shirt was something that would be hard to clean and be made of silk or very expensive fabric. So you would tie some kind of less expensive, fancy fabric in front of you to keep your shirt. I know it's blowing your mind.
Wait,
there's more. To keep your shirt clean, right? And then you would replace that, which would make a lot of sense, especially when you were eating. Oh my God, it's coming around to the food. And so it always drove him absolutely batty when he would see people like in the streets of New York, those guys sitting, you know, eating their falafel from the, or like whatever from the cart.
Yeah, the hot dog.
They flip. Have you seen guys throw their tie over their shoulder to keep the tie? Because, okay, so what a dumb vestige.
It's such a dumb vestige. That, by the way, I love that. And I did not know that. And let's just assume it's true because it's
right.
So good. And don't look it up, please. And if you
I
do,
won't.
Don't correct me.
I won't
me.
Tell you. Right.
But did you know... So one of the things when I was doing research for my first book... I found out that Jeremy Bentham was an early adopter of underwear.
Okay.
And so, I was like, okay, underwear. Do you know what men used to do with before there was underwear to keep their privates kind of
clean?
Not clean, kind of in one location.
Oh, I mean, there's so many things. I think ropes. I don't know.
No, it's their shirt tail. They would just take it, the shirt tail, and pull it up, like kind of like a diaper type thing.
Yeah.
And so Bentham didn't like that because it's a bad idea. And he used underwear.
It is. You know, right.
He used underwear. So
there we go. I mean, all this. So like, I know there's somehow this where we are has something to do with path dependencies and it will come into play. But let me like get back on track. So I'm assuming, I forgot to ask you, are you in New Haven at your home or office?
No, I'm in New York right now.
Oh, so you live in New York and commute to New Haven for work?
Yeah, I live in New Haven, but when during the breaks and weekends and things like that, I come down to New York.
So you're kind of like John McCain with multiple homes?
John McCain with multiple homes.
Remember that? That was a big deal that he had like lots of homes back
right,
in the 2008.
I would just say that I did not marry a very rich person, and I have a very I rent. It's a one bedroom. It's a very modest thing.
I'll stop.
Yeah.
So in other words, you don't have a private jet that you take Supreme Court justices.
I do not. And not only that, I've never been on a private jet, which is a humiliating admission.
I've never been on a private jet.
Then that's good. Now I don't feel as small now.
I've never been fishing. I mean, my backyard is a kid with like potato bugs and worms, but I've never been on like a real fishing trip. How about you?
You mean like the thing that a Supreme Court justice goes on? No,
yes,
I've never
exactly.
done that. I've never done anything like that. I did with John Witt, my colleague. I have gone fishing like in a pond with him. But aside from that, no, I do not do any glamorous outdoor activities like that. I do not go in submersibles. I do not.
Oh God.
I do not rock climb. I don't do any of those things.
Before the show, I was talking to the producers about the submersible searching for the Titanic. And this latest news is that they found a debris field. And like those two words, like on the ocean floor near the Titanic. And those words debris field are kind of like the words grassy knoll. Like if you hear, but less so. I mean, a grassy knoll was probably just a thing until Zapruder, and then that's it. And then now, like debris field. I mean, I feel like debris field always is ominous, but now, I mean, I feel so nauseous when I hear and I keep repeating the words debris field. It's just not good.
I would just say, when have you ever heard debris field and felt relieved?
I know. It is also complicated because I don't want anyone to suffocate to death. And yet I also don't want other people's lives to be ignored based on their class and race. Like the refugees or the migrants who, 500 of them, drown on a boat. Like it's all fraught, and being human is just awful.
No, it is all awful. I don't actually think we should be making fun of people at the bottom of the ocean. That just sounds terrible. But it is also unbelievable that there was this terrible tragedy off the coast of Greece with migrants just a few days ago, and you wouldn't know that it actually happened.
Okay, I'm going to try to turn to happier topics. So I was, in addition to reading your fabulous book and like simultaneously reading and listening so I could see all the drawings and make sure I was like spelling the words correctly, I'd also like decided to like Google you and find out more. And I was reading through your CV and I have never seen so many different courses listed. Do you just keep making up courses when you get bored with the last one that you taught, or?
No. So I have a 2-1 schedule, like three courses load. So normally two out of my three courses are new.
Okay.
Just because I do it for reasons because I don't know anything. And so I just have to, I have to learn things. And
I love that.
I learned them through teaching. So that's why I've taught so many different courses, because I just feel in a perpetual state of ignorance all the time, and I find it extremely irritating.
I find it irritating. That's why I write books and have podcasts. you know, if you knew something, why would you write about it? I mean, don't you want to dig into it and be uncomfortable? And that's what I do. That's why, I mean, I don't know if you know, but my usually, supposedly, to the extent people have fields, supposedly mine was like financial market regulation, because I wrote about the a lot about the financial crisis, and then I wrote about white-collar crime, and now I'm moving into tax policy. And there are people who are, I know, it seems crazy, right? And so
it's extraordinarily important. It is also a bit crazy, but it's a bit, you know, if it, I think, who is it? A tax professor colleague once said to me, is if you want to know what the social contract is in a given society, look at tax policy. You'll see exactly the values of a society.
Well, and there's also this problem too, which is I really like the mechanics of the Fed and plumbing. You know, before I went into teaching, I worked at Fidelity Investments, and I was like the head lawyer for fixed income, so I knew how like the repo, you know, repurchase agreement market and overnight funding, blah blah. I love plumbing, like, you know, if it's a right.
Yeah. So do I. By the way, that's what the book is about, is the plumbing of hacking and the internet and stuff like that. So I really do like that too. But what you just described sounds very complicated.
But you know, what I have to realize is a person, you know, studying tax policy and tax mechanics for a couple of years is never going to know as much as anyone who's been an expert in this. So I'm taking a sort of like Michael Lewis frame. I'm treating myself like a journalist with a law degree. And then people are kind to me and they're super, you know, and it's super interesting. And I can, you know, learn and go to conferences and read a ton of stuff without feeling like, I don't know, like without feeling like I need to be an expert, but I need to be enough of more of an expert than an ordinary reader so I can translate. But let's go back to your book.
No, that's right. So I feel like the same thing is like I try, like my goal, at least with this book, was also to be like the insider's outsider, so to speak.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
So I love that.
Yeah. So I, of course, I'm not pretending to be Mr. Robot or like, I don't hack for a living, though I hack. But like, it's just, you know, I can speak to people in the profession, and they treat me decently.
I think you do a good job, though, too, explaining stuff, concepts. We'll wait for a moment to get into those.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'm going to start at the very beginning of your book, which is the dedication.
Right.
And I love that you dedicated the book to your mother, Elaine Shapiro. And here's what you said. For everything, especially that conversation on 110th Street. So
yes,
what is that conversation?
Yeah. By the way, I just think it's so cool that you asked, because I've had a lot of conversations about the book, and I was just surprised nobody's even brought it up because it's cryptic. So it's actually, I think, it's a beautiful story. So what happened was, like, when I went to law school, and my parents were happy about that. And then when I finished law school, I went and I became a graduate student in philosophy, and my father was just very unhappy about that.
Why?
Because he thought, like, what the hell are you doing? I mean, you know, you're going to be making... And my father was an electrical engineer. He worked at Bell Labs. That plays a role in the book. And I think, you know, I would have made more money than he made, you know, as a lawyer. And I just was like, I don't want to do this. I just don't want to do it. And I think I didn't understand at the time that, you know, parents have, they feel like they have anxiety about their children. They feel like they want to do their job. They want to, you know, he had not finished, so to speak, that because I decided I'm not going to get a job in law. I'm going to go to philosophy. So what happened was I did 6 years of philosophy degree. And as you know, but for people who are listening, so the main, it's slightly less now, but the main job market is run by the American Association of Law Schools, AALS, which used to, it's no longer anymore, but they used to have this one, the conference in November, where you would go and you would, you know, kind of speed dating, you would go interview with all these people, all these schools, and hope to get a job. And I remember sitting outside with my mother on 110th Street right the night before the AALS. And I said to her, what if I don't get a job? Because she knew what that meant was that it would have been the greatest I told you so from my father. And she said, then we'll be here again next year.
I love that.
Yeah. And I just felt like that was like, that may be the greatest gift. I mean, aside from life and all the other, that just, just to tell your, you know, your child that like, it's okay to fail. I believe in you. You can do this. I just felt like, okay, well then maybe I can write a book on cybersecurity. You know, because like, you know, I was allowed to do certain things. So that I think that to me, that was like, I'll never forget that.
And as a parent yourself, do you ever have moments like that?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I mean, to the point that my children don't have marketable skills, but
I resemble that remark.
So anyway, you know, it's all's well that ends and well, at least for me, I hope so. And it will for my children too, I'm sure.
Where were you on 110th Street? Like, why do you remember it was 110th Street?
Oh, because I lived on 118th Street between Amsterdam and Morningside as a graduate student. And
Columbia.
And so when I got a job, I had a little bit more. My last semester, I had a little bit more money. So I only made $9,000 a year. And then my last year, I made $14,000 a year. And I was able to afford a slightly better apartment. It was on 110th Street. It was a sublet. And so that's why I remember clearly. Also, I just remember being in a dark car, unbelievably anxious and depressed. And like, just, I was just wondering if my mother would say, well, then like you do have a law degree. You could go to a law firm or something like that. And that was exactly the wrong thing to say to me at the time, though justified perhaps. And so anyway, that's how I remember.
Well, I'm glad that she did that. I'm glad that you've written all these books. And so now that's sort of the bookends of the book. You have the dedication. I always read the acknowledgments before I read the rest of the book. And I noticed that you thanked your literary agent. And I love this. You said, Elise Cheney, my literary agent, who was supportive of this project from the start, but suggested that 25 hacks was perhaps too much. Better start with 5. Elise never misses. That's great. And you did start with 5. What other advice did you get writing this book? Because I know you've written one on your own, but the one prior to this you wrote with Una Hathaway. So here you are on your own, just maybe with your agent telling you, you know, you can't get this 5,000 pages.
Sure. Right, right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is that, so you know, you've written for the trade too. It's very, we're not trained to do this. We're not trained to write trade books. If anything, we're trained to write legal memos and maybe write, you know, scholarship, but we're not trained to write things for ordinary, for regular people. And so so for example, I was on to do the history of hacking. So it was like, okay, 25 hacks. And Elise was like, well, like 25, it's like really hard to care about 25, you know, characters and 25 things. And I said, well, how many? And she goes, I don't know, 5. So that's what I was like, okay, 5. But the thing is, I'm really blessed with extraordinarily talented editors, agent. So I need this advice because I'm not a professional in that world. And so I need professionals to give me advice.
Because I think, you said we are trained to do something. I definitely resisted that training from the beginning. And now I train students in writing in a persuasive sort of formulaic way, which is quite ironic because I remember, and I teach civil procedure now. And I remember my Civ Pro class where there was some class action question about some poisoning of some body of water in a town, and I decided to write about Ibsen's Enemy of the People instead of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And luckily, Martha Minow didn't fail me. But eventually, I've learned to behave myself. But you're right. Generally speaking, you are writing in a way to be entirely thorough, entirely exact, to cite anyone who's ever said anything about what you've written about, to back up any claim, factual claim you make with a citation. And that's a kind of exact writing that ordinary people really don't want. I mean, you're not supposed to be an encyclopedia, but it's very difficult. It's like being trained as a ballet dancer and then trying to like go dance at a club. You know, you're usually spotted a mile away. And when you're writing to communicate to a real audience, who you're trying to teach, it's more like being in a classroom, maybe? I don't know.
Well, you know, so my wife is a literary agent as well, though not my agent. And so the way she puts it is that academics have a built-in audience of, I don't know, depending on the field, 500 people or something, 1,000 people maybe.
Oh, if you're lucky.
Yeah, if you're right, who already are convinced that your question is interesting. And so you don't have to show why, you know, what you're doing is interesting because you already have an audience that believes it's interesting. The difference is that when you write for the trade, you have to show them why they ought to care because they don't come to it caring. And so that idea of motivating people to care about your question is, I feel, that's the hardest thing to do. Why should you care about the thing that I care about? And you only have a very little amount of space to do that before they click or shut the book or whatever. And so it's very anxiety producing, I find it. That's exactly right. And they don't want every objection and sur-objection and reply. They don't want it all laid out because it's, you know, it's like they have jobs, they have lives that, you know, they would like to relax a little bit while learning something.
And it's even worse than that. And it's funny you use the word trade, but what you mean is trade publishers. What you mean is an audience of non-experts who are curious,
right? That's right.
And I think it's worse than even that because on the one hand, or, you know, you've got like what you want to get across, but there's all this kinds of information that you've got to presume is inside of people's brains. Like, what are their presumptions? So you need to like have them take that stuff out of their brain and deal with that at some point, their misconceptions or the common thoughts about something. But even though you don't want to be thorough, you can't be wrong because you're still going to be read. Those 500 people are still going to read your book and decide whether it's wrong or not. And so that's always like, I don't know how you do your final, do you do a final, like your own fact check where you look at the whole thing all over again and make sure at the very end and galley, is it every, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. You're shaking your head or no. Yeah.
Always. I did a plagiarism check on my book just because, you know, who knows? You know,
if you were typing a quote up that you might have made a mistake, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like it could be. Who knows? I'm unbelievably careful. So the thing is that especially, and this I think is the real issue of anybody who deals with tech in a law school or in some other field is that tech is technical, obviously, and law is technical. So you have an intersection of two very different fields that are really technical. And if you bring in anything about philosophy or history or something, that'll have its own technicality. So how do you do it in such a way where you maintain and keep the reader's interest and comprehension while also not alienating or upsetting colleagues and professionals who you really care about getting it right, because you don't want to mislead people right about things that you yourself care about and your colleagues care about. So it's a really tough thing. And I, the way I deal with it is I just beg people who are experts to read my work.
That's so smart.
Yeah,
I have done that. Yep, yeah, to economists when I had chapters, because I just want them to read it. Did I say this expression wrong? Does everyone already know this other thing? Right. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's a good point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I like for the first book, you know, the first chapter half of it happens in Singapore. So I flew to Singapore and I met the top guy who was like, you know, and so they, people have been, you know, this is another, this is the flip side, that is because experts have such a small audience, they actually really like explaining things to people who are really interested and asking them, can you please help me check my work? I think that they find that enjoyable and they find that responsible. And I'm just so grateful to when people agree to do that. I'm thrilled.
So let's turn to the five hacks, but I'm like, but before we do, you are a hacker, you confessed, and you hacked into the Yale Law School website, annoying your dean, but I wonder what hacking technique you used, or don't you want to say because it might still be vulnerable?
So it's actually so interesting because I had a much better kind of insight into the NSA and what's called the the vulnerabilities equities process. I'll tell you what I mean. So there was this is kind of crazy. So the many libraries or many organizations are not public, their servers are not on the open internet because they're subject to abuse and they can get traffic that they don't want. So typically they hire a company, maybe Fastly, maybe Cloudflare, which acts as a proxy. So you go to the proxy sees whether it's okay and then sends it on. It turns out that this proxy, it's the Independent Library Association or something like that, ran these proxies. But the thing is, they ran these proxies for cybersecurity for the library, and it turns out that they had what was called a cross-site scripting error that I was able to do a reflection attack. So basically what that means is that, so let's say the law library, you go to a catalog, you want to type in fancy, you know, it'll be like a title and you type in Fancy Bear Goes Fishing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's like data. And you want to call it up. So what I did was I typed in code.
Duality you write about.
Yeah, exactly. It's the duality. It's the fact that code and data are intrinsically ambiguous and computers kind of can't tell the difference sometimes. And so I did, and it gave me a reflection attack, and then I was able to copy the URL, this is all I had to do. I had to take the URL, put it in
I'm sorry, stop for one sec. I didn't remember the words. What is reflection attack? I don't remember reading that.
Oh yeah, it wasn't in the book.
Okay, what do you mean by that? You type in the code into the window that should have been the name of your book or any other kind of data. And then what happens next on the screen from there?
It runs
the code. Okay.
Right. And then so if you put in like quote alert, you know, it'll put up an alert box.
Okay.
And so that means that website is not just accepting data, it's also running code.
Okay.
And so what you can do is you can put in code which will produce a URL that has the Yale Law Library beginning. You know, it'll say www.yale.edu/ you know, law library, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Then you can put it, you could have some malicious code in the URL or pointing to some malicious code. And all I had to do is put it in email to my dean and say, "Dear Heather, look what the library is buying." You know,
she clicked on the link.
No, she didn't. Oh. I didn't do it. That would have been that last step.
I see.
I had set everything up, I won't say what her response was, but
But if she had actually clicked on that, what would have happened next?
Well, I mean, I would have had access to her account.
And you would have known what books she was checking out of the library, or?
No, I would know, like, you know.
Oh, everyone's, you know, oh, you would know what was going on with Amy Chua and Jed. Oh, never mind. I shouldn't talk about that.
I mean, you know, I could find out about anybody.
Anything.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So her response was probably not very happy with you about that. I don't think you violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
I did not violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. But I will just tell you that when I had this, I was supposed to do a demo in front of, I had a presentation, and I told my partner about it, but told my partner I'm not going to tell anybody. And my partner was like, wait, you really should tell IT. And I was like, no, I'm not going to burn my exploit. You know, this is like, and he said, do you think that's like being a good colleague to IT? And I'm like, no, it's actually not. You're right.
So anyway, I
kind of learned something about it, which is that, like, no, this was my discovery. And I didn't want to tell anybody. I don't want to burn it. And that ultimately was,
that psychology, though, is behind a lot of the pride in finding. I mean, it's funny that there are people who don't understand why people would be hackers. And I remember when I was back practicing law, there was an older guy who was like, why do these people do it? I'm because they're bored, they're resentful. They want to feel, you know, they're not usually, you know, trained in elite schools, and they're angry that they haven't gotten the recognition they want. And I know that's not your situation, but there's sort of pride in discovery. But I'm glad your partner kind of got you to be a responsible citizen.
No, that's right. I just wanted to say this, like, it's not like I don't know why my ego needed that, but obviously it did. Although luckily my superego took control. But I really get it. It's really fun to find something that nobody knows about. It's really fun to exploit it. It's really fun to have this kind of secret power. But ultimately, it's a very bad idea. Since it was my first time. And so I teach students how to hack, and I tell them this story. And I also tell them every class, you're going to want to break the law. Don't break the law. And so I actually make them, for their final projects, I make them speak to me. And to tell me what their projects are, because you would be surprised, like, what kind of harebrained schemes they come up with. And it's based on enthusiasm, but it's also dangerous.
Yeah. It's funny. And your third, I'm going to take it out of order for a second, because what you just said reminded me of the third hack you focus on from 2005, when a teenager named Cameron LaCroix hacked into Paris Hilton's T-Mobile device called a Sidekick, which was kind of an early adopter of the thing we now all have in iPhones, which is you can have a lot of data and photos and stuff on the device. But it wasn't that made me crack up. It was that later, after he'd been given a second chance, he like hacked into the Burger King Twitter account. How can you not laugh? I know it's wrong, but can you remind me of what he did and how...
So the thing is, so just to say about Cameron. So Cameron, I've spoke to him several times. He had a very bad childhood. His mother died of an opioid overdose when he was a year and a half old. He had to raise his younger brother. He had depression, mental health issues. And he got into the world of hacking, as so many young boys do, through gaming and the like, and a sense of power. He went to jail. He went to juvenile detention for the hack of Paris Hilton. So when he got out, he continued to commit crimes. One of them was to hack Twitter and various Twitter accounts, Burger King being one of them, saying that Burger King just acquired McDonald's. But it's also true that I think he was suffering from chemical dependency at that at that point. I asked him why he kept on. So he's 32 now. He's out of jail. I feel like he's gotten his life together. He has a good job, and I won't mention where it is. Family, children. I asked him. So, given everything, why did you keep on committing these crimes? Like, why did you do the Burger King hack? And he said, well, you know, when I got the terms of probation were that I wasn't allowed to use a computer. And he's like, first of all, I'm 16 years old. I'm 18 years old. How am I not going to have a cell phone? But more than that, for 2 years, he had to be a dishwasher because cashiers, a cash register is a computer. So everything was a computer. And he said, like, it made it kind of impossible for him to live a normal life given the parole conditions. And so sometimes happens is that when the thing is like, there's no way I can abide by this anyway, the heck with it. And this changed in 2017 when the Supreme Court said you can't actually, the First Amendment requires that people on parole have access to to social media, for example. I when I speak to these people, I always want to know why. Can you just tell me why you did what you did? I'm very curious. And you know, lots of times they tell you things which are really, really interesting and makes you and puts everything in a different perspective.
And let's go back to his hack, since I mentioned him, and I just want to, as I sort of mention the role of T-Mobile, similar to the role of Microsoft, which you'll talk about later. You know, these companies that were trying to get a lot of people to adopt their hardware wanted apps made and didn't decided it would be too costly to really examine the code to make sure there wasn't a way to hack into it. But it turns out the way Cameron LaCroix hacked into Paris's Sidekick was pretty basic. It was about human error. And that is the same story that happened with the DNC in 2016. So can you walk through what happened and what he got from her? And then I just have to read this funny thing that her friend said.
Oh, yeah. So what happened was,
Hold on one second. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but some people don't maybe know who Paris Hilton is. We have readers who listen. I mean, that might be shocking, but so in your telling of this, maybe lay it all out.
Sure. So I would say that this is true. It's very upsetting because sometimes when I talk about Paris Hilton to my students, they don't know who it is, which just is unbelievable because like every other sentence had Paris Hilton in it.
Students hadn't watched Succession. And I mean, come on. I mean, they are law students and they're busy reading and we don't necessarily want them on TV.
You know, there are certain
all the
things
time
that are part of general Western civilization at this point, and I think Succession is one of them.
Thank God you said that.
So Paris Hilton was the it girl. She's famous for being famous. After 2001, she was just everywhere. And in 2005, her cell phone was hacked, and intimate photos of her topless were then leaked onto the internet. And I was really interested in, first of all, because I was like, how did this possibly happen? I mean, she's like the most famous person in the world in 2005 or next to it. And, you know, she's surrounded by paparazzi and bodyguards. How did they get to her cell phone?
And I have to interrupt you again, though, because you've got to go back in time because it's the second time she'd been. Right. Prior to that, her boyfriend had leaked a sex tape of her.
Yeah. So Rick Solomon had done this like beyond belief thing of they had made consensually, at least for that purpose, a video of them having sex. And he not only sold it to an adult film distributor, but he put at the beginning a dedication to the people who died in 9/11 with the burning U.S. flag. I mean, just the
unbelievable
the degree of bad taste and just utter violation. And it is unbelievable. And I mean, I liked Paris Hilton, you know, from reading about. I mean, she I had obviously a very flamboyant lifestyle, but I mean, she always struck me as very smart, and I did not like the fact that like she was hacked, and I was just really was interested in like, why did anybody do this? How did they do it? And nobody, until I published the book, nobody knew how he had actually done it, because I only was able to speak to him 2 weeks before the book went to press to find out how it actually happened. So basically the FBI raids his house for doing stuff on AOL, some kind of hacking stuff on America Online, and they take away his sidekick one, which is the cell phone that he used to communicate with his friends. You could play games on it. You could send texts. It was like a new thing. Now, one of the things that people don't realize is kind of stereotype of a hacker is that they are lone wolves, that they have mental health issues, and they just stay alone in their apartment hacking or their basement hacking. And the truth is that they're highly social. The motivation for hackers are, you know, kind of peer recognition. And he was really, really upset because he now no longer had a phone because the FBI had taken it away, and he wanted another phone. So he engaged in some credit card fraud, bought a new phone, but he needed a T-Mobile account. He remembers seeing a commercial involving Snoop Dogg and Paris Hilton. It's a T-Mobile account. Paris Hilton thinks it's really cool that Snoop Dogg is doing his laundry by himself. She says he does his own laundry. That's hot. So Cameron, first thing he does is he calls up the T-Mobile, a T-Mobile store in California after school. And he says, hi, I'm calling from corporate headquarters. There's some problem with the system. Will you please give us your credentials so we can check? And the manager just gives him his password, the username and password. And he said, okay, good. And he looks into it, and he thinks, oh, I'm gonna get my own T-Mobile account. So he gets his own T-Mobile account, and he notices that when he types, when he does this from his sidekick, T-Mobile doesn't send him a code. They just believe that he's a T-Mobile customer because he owns a sidekick. So he remembers that Paris Hilton from the commercial, maybe she's a T-Mobile customer. So he types in Paris Hilton, gets her phone number, and then he goes to his browser and tells his browser, pretend to be a sidekick. And which is really easy to do. You just change the user agent in the bottom, he gets the password prompt. He changes it, and
so the server he goes to thinks the device logging in is a sidekick, and thinks it's not just any sidekick, but it's Paris Hilton or someone, and that she just wants to redo her password.
Exactly, because how does anybody know her phone number? And how are they doing it on a sidekick unless it's Paris Hilton? I mean, this is like you.
This is the worst security, though. I can't believe it.
I mean, it borders on no security. But what is fascinating is I hate to be, you know, like to agree with certain things, but. With certain people that I don't normally agree with, but you would really be surprised how inaccurate, how much fake news there is about hacking. So people said, security professionals said the most outrageous things about how it happened. Like, she's really dumb, so she probably had a stupid password, or it was so easy to guess her security. The answer to the security question. There was a New York Times had on the front page a security company going to the Oscars with software-defined radios in their backpack, saying, "Oh, celebrities are now using Bluetooth, so therefore, probably." The hacker hacked into the Bluetooth of Paris Hilton, even though Paris Hilton wasn't there at the time. It's called blue snarfing, hacking Bluetooth. And this is not only is it hard to black to hack Bluetooth, but the New York Times never checked to see whether the Sidekick 2 actually had Bluetooth. It did
and
not.
It didn't. That was so funny.
So I just so there's so much. Every time there's a hack comes out, everyone says Russia, Russia, Russia. And it sometimes it is Russia, and Fantasy Bear really was Russia. But in the other cases I deal with, they turn out to be young boys.
And that just one more piece of the Paris Hilton hack. You mentioned that it was topless photos and things, but it was not just that. It was all of her emails and her texts and so on. And so her friend, I guess the New York Times has interviewed one of her friends who said, asked her, well, you know, why is this such a big deal? And the friend said she was pretty upset about it. It's one thing to have people looking at your sex tapes, but having people reading your personal emails is a real invasion of your privacy, which is Gen Z, I guess.
I will just say one thing. That is true, because that's what like struck out at me. Like, I'm sorry. Call me a prude, but if a sex tape of me is leaked on the internet, I'm not leaving my house for a long time.
On the other hand, if I look like Paris Hilton, I probably wouldn't care.
I will care regardless of how.
No, I would care. My parents would be ashamed, and my grandmothers would be rolling in their grave and such.
No, I know. It really would be a very bad thing. But I will say, when you read her notes, they are really, really embarrassing.
Like, I guess, but they're not embarrassing.
So
put some of them in the book. They're funny.
Yeah, they're funny. You know, so somebody asked me, am I re-victimizing her
by putting
it in the book? And I just thought, no, because like this is as public record as it gets. By the way,
with that first sex tape, she ended up, I think, settling with him and just taking a piece of the profit, right?
So she claims $400,000. She got $400,000, which she also claims was donated to charity.
Uh huh.
I would just want to. Okay. I don't know what happened. I just want to be. That's what was claimed.
So I realized, kind of like your agent. I mean, there's no way we're going to cover all five hacks when we're talking. But I want to encourage people to read this book. I thought it was so straightforward. As I noted, I listened and I read so I could see the different diagrams. But I think, I guess I will give you some choices and how we proceed with the time we have left. One way to proceed would be to talk about that very first hack with Robert Morris Jr. from 1988. And another way would be either while we're doing that or separately to kind of deal with some of the vocabulary of hacking. And I guess the final thing would be to just like jump over all of this and tell me why I shouldn't be worried that AI drones are going to come kill us all.
Okay, let's save AI for the end.
Okay, great.
Because, I mean, obviously everyone's interested in AI right now. So the most natural place to start a kind of history of hacking would be the first time that the internet went down because somebody released a self-replicating program, a computer worm, onto the internet. Now, the person who did this, Robert Morris Jr., I feel like a kind of very strong bond with him, though I've never met him or spoken to him. We're the same age. His father worked at the same place that my father worked.
Bell Labs.
Bell Labs, right. He was really, really into Unix, operating system that was developed by Bell Labs. So was I. My father used to bring home all, you know, breadboards and diodes, and I used to play with them, and I studied computer science in college. And what's amazing is that he and his friend Paul Graham. So Paul Graham, do you know who this is? The Paul Graham who started Y Combinator, who's now he's an unbelievably successful a venture capitalist, started Dropbox, tried Airbnb. So Robert, they had this idea that, like, maybe for his thesis, he would write a self-replicating program and release it onto the internet to see how many, how big the internet was, how many hosts he could infect. And Robert Morris Jr. was really, who was really into Unix. So he knew all the vulnerabilities, and he was very clever in how he exploited them.
He's at Cornell at the time, right?
He was at Cornell at the time. He was a first-year graduate student. He released it November 2nd, 1988, at 8 o'clock at night. He went to dinner, comes back, realized he crashed the internet. Now, what's the pathos of this whole thing, aside from the fact that he is indicted and then he's convicted in a trial, though he doesn't go to jail, is the fact that he has to tell his dad that he crashed the internet. But his dad at the time is the chief scientist for cybersecurity at the National Security Agency. So he calls up Marilyn and he has to tell his dad, "Dad, I crashed the internet."
I love how you do that in the book, that he's got to call the head of NASA, and then he rings and a woman answers the phone and says, "Mom, can I talk to Dad?"
Right, yeah. But for the grace of God and a little coding and not such great in coding ability, that could have been me. And I just really feel for him. And what I tried to do in the book was explain how the worm worked, but also why did it happen? Like, why is the internet insecure? Why was he able to exploit it in the way that he is, that he did? And then also just walk people through the trial. The trial is the first time that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is actually litigated. There's a very famous case, United States versus Morris, which sets out some of the standards for it. But also is just a really interesting example of, law is code too. What I call upcode, but it's different than downcode in the sense that since it's informal, it's subject to interpretation. And so even though they have very strong similarities, law and computer code, law is different than computer code in the sense that the compiler interprets things in one way, whereas the judge can interpret them in multiple ways, and in fact did not interpret it in the way that Robert Morris Jr. Enabled him to get exonerated. He's convicted.
You know, I just, as you're saying this, I'm just thinking about in the frame of civil procedure being like summary judgment is where the judge decides he or she is going to be the operating system and doesn't let the jury run the code.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And so one way to think about it is that the judge sets the code, the jury finds the data, applies it to the code. And I mean, that's a very, kind of simplistic way of describing it.
But that's thank certain. You. I came up with the simplistic.
You did
in your book.
We're supposed to also be, we're law professors, so we're supposed to be a little bit more sophisticated about the law and say, yes, right, they're not really, the jury's not really a computer. There's always a mixture of law and fact. So that's why I wanted to say.
I know. So I really think that, I love the way you told the story. And I also loved how, I know you can only deal with five hacks, but you still do a lot of backstory around, like when you get to 1989 with the Dark Avenger in Bulgaria, you're able to tell a lot of backstory, including about this really cool guy, Johnny Van Neumann, before there even were the kinds of computing power we're talking about, who came up with these ideas of self-replication. And I just thought, likening that to a 3D printing machine and then a 2D machine was so helpful, Scott. Like,
thank
I just
you.
There's a lot that just clicked.
Thank you.
I wish we could, I guess one one thing I would want to talk about, since you've raised it, I guess, is kind of the cat and mouse piece of this, because the mouse, I guess, that the mice are these, you know, for the most part, all entirely, maybe almost entirely young boys, some adult men. You talk about, at one point, you liken these groups that were kind of fighting each other as these teenage boys playing Cyber King of the Mountain. But then you also have, like, law enforcement trying to kind of chase them down. And yet, you know, this thing keeps going round and round, wondering what you think the best upcode could be put in place to maybe put the incentive and responsibility somewhere to protect our data. Because one thing we haven't talked about really is that none of this is victimless. Yeah, it's really funny when Burger King puts a tweet out saying they've been taken over by McDonald's. But that, you know, when you crash the entire internet, students can't take their exams, people don't get their medication, hospitals go offline, people die. We could go on and on and on. This isn't like we have skipped the victims here. And the fact that, and again, with the upcode, you pointed out that, you know, unlike a toaster that blows up and injures someone, if you have a device that crashes and therefore you lose money, the torts, you know, our tort system isn't going to recognize purely economic damage losses. And so we don't really have, I think, or maybe it's getting better, but what is the appropriate, do you think, legal regime, the upcode, to manage the sort of cat and mouse game that leaves the rest of us as victims?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things I find slightly infuriating is the way in which the tech world, cyberspace, is a vast, vast area of legal impunity. The theory being, you know, technology is the source of national wealth and power, and we can't regulate this thing because it's going to stifle innovation. You know, it's no wonder that you have these people making, you know, billions and billions of dollars hand over fist, because there's very little they can get sued for. Now, certain things, I'm a big fan of certain types of immunity for on the internet. I think, you know, why don't I want to say Section 702?
230.
Yeah, 230. I'm sorry. Yeah, Section 230. That's great. I think platforms should not be held liable. There are some tricky cases about CSAM, revenge pornography, things like that. But in the main, that's right. But how the hell do software developers still have legal immunity for software vulnerabilities that they negligently create? That's how you get like the T-Mobile stuff, where it just assumes you're a T-Mobile customer because your browser says that you're a sidekick too. And so President Biden in the National Cybersecurity Strategy has just endorsed having software liability for security vulnerabilities. And that's one very strong, I think, form of regulation. I mean, one thing that we know from people who study the law and, you know, watch things is that if you don't give corporations and businesses reasons to internalize their costs, they're not going to internalize their costs. And so they haven't internalized their costs. So maybe we should make them internalize their costs, much like what Ralph Nader did at the end of the 60s, get people to realize that actually automobile manufacturers need to put in seatbelts, they need to make their cars safer, and right. That really vastly increased highway safety. I would also have much stronger regulation of the cryptocurrency market, which, as far as I can tell, its primary use case is criminals, I'd like to see more regulation.
And speculators. It's like asset speculation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so.
But you mean in terms of as a medium of exchange, yeah.
Yes, as a medium of exchange. I'm not saying that nobody uses it for good purposes, but that's primarily what it's being used for. I also think that a lot more effort should be spent trying to divert young offenders away from jail and away from punitive forms of punishment that will lead to escalation, and try to do what other countries have are doing successfully, like in the UK and the Netherlands, which is diverting young offenders away from the dark side, so to speak, and into the legitimate cybersecurity industry and into mentorship, which is really, really important for these people. So if I could just say that, yes, the cat, there's a cat and mouse game, and there's no way perfect cybersecurity is impossible. It's just that there's so many ways to intervene in the upcode. There's so many ways of affecting social norms, legal norms, education systems, so that we can make things better than they are now without
throwing. Okay, before we, I like that. And I like how you're in the book, you mentioned the Securities and Exchange Commission creating disclosure and board discussion requirements. But I want to ask, before we get to AI, a couple quick things. In the book, you noted that in 1993, there are about 150 viruses in the wild. Do you think that number has come down? And I'll double these up. And with the Internet of Things, this is what shocked me the most, you know, whether it's your smart thermostat or doorbell or what have you, I didn't realize that those all had preset passcodes, and I could care less about it. And now I find out that then these things can be used to bring down the internet, even if I don't care whether someone can look at my, you know, what's going on outside of my house with my doorbell. So can you address both the sort of, has it changed in terms of viruses and the new threats?
Yeah, sure. So I would say viruses themselves have, you know, largely disappeared. By a virus, I mean something that doesn't spread by networks and requires user execution, as opposed to a worm, which is autonomous, meaning that it spreads via networks without user input. So worms, there are lots of worms. They're unbelievably difficult to stop. They're really difficult to stop because they spread so quickly. Viruses themselves have been largely eradicated. There are some versions of them. You know, WhatsApp has their own worms, and Facebook, there are specific
problems. How do we protect ourselves then from worms, for example?
Okay, well, there's nothing you can do to protect yourself from a worm that's new. There just isn't. If a worm exploits your current operating system, that's that. But what you should do is you should stay patched. And one of the great things that Microsoft did was they took the internet, which had been previously the main way in which infections were spread, and turned it into a vaccine delivery system through Microsoft Defender and things like that, which act as endpoint protections. So now things get pushed really quickly to your endpoint over the internet, and that's really good.
So I think what you're trying to say, just to be clear, is that when my iPhone tells me there's a security update, don't keep waiting. Plug the phone in and get the security update.
Yeah. Just do it, because it's such an incredible pain in the ass if you don't. And the thing is that your apps are going to stop working anyway. I like that fact about Apple now. It's like functionality starts to degrade if you don't have the update. So that's a really good thing. But I just tell people, basically, you know, the thing that you can do most, except, you know, even better than patching, and you should definitely do that, just don't click or download anything from somebody you don't know. So in this day and age, you are allowed to say, "I'm sorry, who are you? Can you tell me more about yourself?" It's perfectly acceptable to say, "Hi, thanks for writing. Can you tell me a bit more about yourself so I can know why you're writing?" You know, just simple things like not clicking on links or not downloading things from people you don't know will, you know, because the hackers don't really care about you. They're just in it for the quick buck. And if you give them a little friction, they'll move on.
Yeah, I think that's, or any time you think someone that's a service provider says you've had a security breach, I mean, that's often, you know, Facebook did that for a while where there was somebody claiming to be, I'm sorry, it was Twitter security, but it was like a dot something else and people clicked on it immediately and then someone took over their account and tried to sell, scam people for software. It's just so easy when people think, as you noted in the book, something that, you know, it's not endowment bias, but that people don't want to lose something.
Yeah,
so someone tells you someone's stolen.
Right. Loss aversion. So what I say is just slow yourself down. Anytime you feel scared, just say, I feel scared. I'm going to want to act quickly. Don't. Just take a breath. That they Zelle, like when you transfer money to Zelle, they say, are you sure this isn't a scam? That just stops you for a second and thinks, oh, is this a scam? So just like when you say something in a workshop or in a classroom, you think to yourself, is this a good question? Well, I sound silly doing this. Ask yourself, well, I feel silly clicking on this link in a minute. Just slow yourself down.
I do this with journalists. I remember a journalist emailed me who I didn't know. And even if you think you recognize the address, it was like a Gmail address. I was like, well, they're not emailing me from, you know, the publication they claim they're working for. So I went around them, went to the publication's website and saw if someone, and they were like, why'd you do that to me? And I said, oh, because, you know, I'm very cautious. I was this
God
person who
you.
Jacob Wall sent me an email trying to entrap me into like, oh, you've got to Google this, Scott, way back in 2018, trying to get me to say that was going to pay me money to say that I knew Robert Mueller when I never met him. And I got this email. I'm like, I'm not even going to respond to this guy. And I forwarded to the special counsel's office, whatever. Oh, it was insane.
Jesus, wow.
But, you know, so I have to be, you know, the only time I make those mistakes is if you're tired or you're so like, don't react. It's really important to always be suspicious of people. It might not even be you say someone you know, but someone could have your friends hacked your friend's account. There's no, you know, you got to be really, if something looks weird or feels weird, don't open an attachment. Don't click on it.
Yeah, exactly. Just say, excuse me, can you tell me more?
Now, let's talk about artificial intelligence and why I shouldn't be particularly nervous that a drone's going to come kill all of us. I mean, there aren't enough drones to do that. So, but beyond that.
Well, so I want to say several things. So first of all, one of the messages in the book is that all security tools are dual use. What can be used for good can be used for bad. What can be used for bad can be used for good. Most people don't realize that AI and machine learning has been in the field at least 10 years protecting your network. When the IT says, oh, I think we have a security incident, it's probably some AI, some machine learning tool telling them this does not look normal. So that's the first thing I would say. Number two is like, it is true that AI is getting more sophisticated, but it's also getting more sophisticated. So, tools that could be used to harm us could also be developed to help us. I think the more the technology advances, the better the defense we'll have. I think this kind of these large language models are not what we think they are.
A new
paper just came out. A colleague of mine who was at a formal verification conference sent it to me. So it turns out that like if you ask a logic problem, a very standard logic problem to ChatGPT, it'll get the right answer, but it'll have the wrong reasoning. If you just change, there's a very famous example called Who Killed Aunt Agatha? It's like a clue kind of thing. And you're given all these kind of clues about who killed Aunt Agatha. And it turns out that, you know, if you use first order logic, it's really obvious that Agatha killed Aunt Agatha. Okay. Mm-hmm. But ChatGPT can't figure that out, even though it gets the right answer. What this paper did was it just changed the names. Instead of Agatha, it changed it to Split. Instead of the butler, it changed it to Splat. Instead of killing, it was moved diagonally. Now, from a logical point of view, these are completely the same things. It got the wrong answer. It couldn't. It didn't know what to say. And what you realize is that these things are not symbolic reasoners. They are not forming internal representations that then get where the conclusions are being derived by logic. No, they're pattern matchers. And if there's anything that they can't pattern match to, like split, splat, and splut, they just fold. Now, I don't see how super AIs are coming out of that technology anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I think if the thing can't even do like baby logic,
right.
How powerful can this thing do? It's designed to be the next search engine.
It reminds me a lot of Wikipedia. It's like, it's basically scraping Wikipedia and representing stuff to you, it seems
to me.
Yeah, it's
exactly right. And there's so much snake oil. I mean, I don't know if you saw this thing about how now GPT-4 can answer, apparently could answer the entire curriculum of the MIT Electrical Engineering undergraduate syllabus. And so when this came out, a bunch of these students, undergraduates, looked at it and they realized that it just wasn't true. Like at least 10% of the questions had no answers to them, so it couldn't have gotten 100% right. They retrained.
Oh, yeah.
The thing is, so... You know, if you follow anything about tech, it's like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing in the world. Oh no, we're gonna die. Oh, here's the next thing. It's the greatest thing in the world. Oh no, we're gonna die. So I just feel like, you know, let's worry about climate change. Let's worry
about
that.
Sounds like my childhood. What? Oh, I grew up in Michigan, a suburb outside of Detroit.
Oh, okay. I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey.
Oh, wasn't there a poet? Who's the poet who's from? Is it William Carlos Williams?
Yeah,
no, it's
Carlos Williams. Yeah. But it was an awful place to grow up. So.
Why did you grow up there? Because your dad was at Bell Labs?
My parents, they were like immigrant family, and like that's where they knew people who had moved, so they moved there. You know, that's how things, you know, if you knew some people there, so you moved there, and it was better, you know, it was a dying industrial town. By the time I became of age, it had already been dead.
There's two things I want to tell you that our lives maybe overlapped a little bit before we end things. One is when I got out of law school, I worked at Weil Gotshal in New York, and I was in the trade practices department, which was sort of half antitrust and sort of half IP. And my first client was Bellcore, which was the spinoff when the Department of Justice breaks up AT&T. So you had the regional Bell operating companies that did local. And then obviously AT&T did long distance. They called it, inter versus inter exchange. And Bellcore was obviously, in theory, a consortium of, in theory, competitors. So you had to have antitrust review of anything they did under rule of reason. But they also were not allowed to manufacture, because that was part of how the split up and the breakup went. So anytime they had to make a prototype in a test bed, we had to like write a opinion about why that was okay. But it was pretty cool. I loved the telecom work there. And then also in your book, you talk a lot about CompuServe. Remember the CompuServe era? And I worked for a company called CUC, that later became Sendent, and the people kind of went to jail. But before that happened, there was a buying club that they first did on CompuServe and AOL. And then when things broke through on the internet, they were selling stuff on the internet. But anyway,
right.
So all this stuff is, I remember these eras quite well. And just reading, I thought it was very familiar, the folks who made the wrong bets about trying to have a closed, walled off sort of universe versus letting people have a gateway into the internet, and what bad choices some companies made. I think you said Microsoft made the bad choice there.
Yeah, Microsoft made the bad choice. So my father did, after Bell Labs and AT&T was broken, he worked for Bellcore. And he worked for Bellcore. And the thing was, is that Judge Green was the most hated person in my household because he destroyed this great thing. And now, of course, my father was like he was at Rider College, and he was recruited, which is a small college in New Jersey, and he was recruited by Bell Labs, and he got a PhD through Bell Labs and everything like that. So for him, it was like this World Historical Institution, which it was at the time, which lifted him from obscurity to be like a, trained him and everything. And then this judge, for reasons which he can't really understand, breaks it up. And he was really unbelievably upset by that.
It was really weird because back then, you know, speaking of closed databases, LexisNexis, there was a whole special database that all it had was Judge Green's decisions. And I knew, like, the cold. What a weird existence. That was like 50% of my time. It was really fun. And I think about this. I got out of law school in 93. And by 96, they had ended that, right? I guess in 96 with the Telecom Act, they had to let them all merge back together.
Yeah, I don't know the end story because in 96 that's when I graduated my PhD. And that's when the conversation on 110th Street happened. So I had already kind of like blocked out all that engineering stuff and 30 years later back to it, 25. Yeah.
Okay, so what did I not ask? I mean, there's a million things I didn't ask you about, but in your parting thoughts, what do you still want to talk about and how do people find you?
What do I want to talk about? So I would just say the following thing, that just when I just want to make the pitch just for the book would be like, if you ever originally, the book was called Insecurity, and the point was not just that, like, our devices are insecure, we're insecure. We're insecure that we live in this information society that we don't understand, or at least I didn't understand it. And I had, like, a really good technical background, and I still didn't understand it. And so if you ever want to kind of understand it, or understand part of it, of course you can't, it's obviously to what I try to explain, but, you want to understand like, what are people talking about when they're talking about hacking? I think the book would be, might be congenial to you. They can find me, normally at, this website called an app called Twitter.
What's your Twitter handle for those who want to find you?
It's @ScottJ Shapiro. If you, I don't know how long we'll all be at Twitter, but I'm still there. I'm still sticking it out.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you have to, right? I guess you have to. That's where people are.
Yeah. That's where people are. And that's just the platform, and it's getting worse and worse. This whole, you know, trans cis stuff isn't just absolutely
ridiculous,
barbaric.
And to be clear, when you're saying it's not barbaric that people use CIS, cis, to identify themselves, but it's barbaric that you're saying that Elon Musk is going to use that as a slur.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just to be
please,
clear.
Please.
Yeah. I mean, I know that you mean that.
Yeah. Yeah. What I mean to say, he has declared that cis is, or cisgender is, a slur, which that's news to me. But I certainly don't. I think of myself. I would identify as cishet, a white male. So I don't think of it at all as a slur. I just think his transphobia is barbaric.
I think he has a trans child too.
Yeah, he does. That's why I said, you know,
which is even just criminal practically to do that to your child.
Men would, as I tweeted yesterday, men would rather spend $44 billion than go to family therapy.
That's what that was about. I wondered who you were referring to.
Yeah. Okay. I was referring to, like, he has a child who, is wrestling or whatever, identifies in a certain way. Like, why are you going to make this your mission in life? Anyway, that's somebody's family, but he's impinging on other families, which is really upsetting.
Well, thank you for raising that, because I had not yet, and I think it's really important to take that stand. So, well, thank you so much for all of your time, Scott. Enjoy New York when the skies are clear and not filled with smoke.
It's been bad here, but, you know, one day it would be lovely to see you in person.
Well, that would be difficult because I don't actually exist. This has been ChatGPT interviewing you.
I did wonder why there was an arm coming out of your forehead, but
yeah, that's why.
But
yeah,
you know what?
Weird.
But I don't like to comment on people's physical appearances.
Yeah, so, I know. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I've got to. I'm not so far from New Haven, and you know, I like an excuse to go visit Sterling Library. I was there last summer visiting. In the library, they have some of the Taft archives.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is, yeah. You know, I have this weird obsession with President Taft. So.
Well, our dean, our past dean, our former dean, Robert Post, wrote the Taft volume. It's coming out soon, but the Taft volume for the Holmes Devise. So he's done.
Oh.
So he's done like 1,300 pages of research on Taft Court. So.
Wow. Well, I'll have to add that to my Taft collection. There you go. Well, thanks, Scott.
Okay, sure. Anyway, thank you so much. This was really, when I say really fun, it genuinely was really fun. Like, I really forgot I was on a podcast. I just thought I was talking to this really interesting person.
Well, I'm glad because we haven't actually recorded it. This was sort of like the warm up.
Okay.
Tomorrow we'll come back.
And we're rolling. Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
That conversation with Scott could have gone on so much longer. I wish you could see all of the notes I have here. I don't know what in the world I was actually thinking. I have like a long list of all the vocabulary and concepts I wanted him to talk about. I think he did give us the distinction between what is a worm and what is a virus, but we didn't get to the sort of hybrid forms like the worm or the virus. He also didn't get to talk that much about these cool concepts, upcode, downcode, and metacode. Or this idea of the difference between something, some kind of crime that would be cyber-enabled versus cyber-dependent. I guess you're really going to have to read the book to dig into that. But I know, and I know you expect me to always push the books that I feature here, because I wouldn't have selected the books or the authors to speak with if I didn't think these were going to be good. But I really can't encourage you enough to either pick up Fancy Bear Goes Fishing or listen to it, because if you have never really thought that much about how the internet is comprised, how and why people can hack into it and into our devices, you'll really enjoy this and it will be entirely mind expanding. Plus, Scott has a really fantastic sense of humor, which totally shines through this book. So thank you again, always, for listening to us. And I will be back next week, same place, same time, to have another episode where we will explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please let us know what you think of Booked Up. You can send me an email at bookedup@politicon.com or write to all of us at Booked Up at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and all of our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really will help other people find us.